In order to support our show, we need the help of some great advertisers. And we want to make sure those advertisers are ones you'll actually want to hear about. We need to learn a little bit more about you to make that possible. Go to podsurvey.com/firstdegree and take a quick anonymous survey that will help us get to know you better. That way we can bring on advertisers that you won't want to skip. And once you've completed the quick survey, you can enter for a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Terms and conditions apply. Again, that's podsurvey.com/firstdegree. podsurvey.com/firstdegree. Thanks for your help. Welcome to Killing Time, hosted by two girls, one goth. I am very excited about today's episode.
Me too.
We have, like, when you know when the stars align and a lot of prep goes into these killing times, and like the first degree, I don't know why we've done this to ourselves, but for both the first degree and Killing Time, we kind of rely on outside sources to bring us our content.
Honestly, and we like behold ourselves to this, which is so...
We never had to.
No, we could have literally been like, we're talking about whatever the fuck we want today. But instead we're like, no, we're going to have a rigid principle-based like reason why we discuss things, which have limited us and made life a lot harder.
Yes, people have to come to us. It has to be a certain date. It's
yeah. Well, I mean, even for the first degree, it's funny because, you know, sometimes we get asked like, why don't you cover this case? It's like, well... We literally can't unless we get somebody that comes to us that's willing to talk about said case. Like, it's not that easy. We're not like any other.
We don't reach out because we're like, we don't want to upset anyone who doesn't want to talk.
And we also just can't cover a case without having an interview. So we can't, like, not like these other crime podcasts that are out there that can just be like, you know what we're going to talk about? Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And we're going to pull a Wikipedia and we're going to fucking talk about it. It's like, we can't do that. We need someone willing and connected enough to talk about it.
Yeah.
And same with Killing Time. I mean, we didn't have to do this either, but we do.
Again, we're masochists in this way.
We're masochists, but we like being inspired by our surroundings.
That's right.
Today was it's like the stars aligned. It gave us something good, and we're really excited to dive into it. So.
The dark day.
Without further ado.
December 9th is the day that Michael Peterson called 911 to say that his wife, Kathleen, was just found at the bottom of the stairs in their Forest Hills, Durham, North Carolina house/mansion.
Mansion.
He said she had fallen down 15, 20, I don't know, stairs. He said he was at the pool and he had come in at around 2:40 to find her at the stairs and said that, you know what, she must have fallen down because... She had drank a lot and also taken some Valium.
They're out drinking that night, apparently conversing by the pool. They're
having just a delightful time. I'm picturing like the southern rich mansion sitch. And then it's like, someone goes inside and a tragedy strikes.
Yes.
But as we all know, listening to this, like, it's one of the greatest controversies.
Of the true crime. Of recent true crime.
I think everybody has an opinion on the guilt of Michael Peterson. What would follow was obviously a wild trial where several things were brought up that shocked people, including a death of a previous romantic partner who ended.
We will get into later. Ooh.
Yes. Also,
sorry, I'm getting so excited.
Also, by the way, in a very, very similar situation.
Yeah, we'll get into that later. Do we want to kind of go through the series of events that night now, or do we want to save that for later?
Let's save it.
I think we should save it for
later. You're right.
But
I was just getting ahead of myself.
These sort of locked door type mysteries, which me and Lex just went through with Unraveled, Mystery at the Mansion, there's so much nuance to it, and there's so much family intrigue to it because everybody takes sides, and then it really comes down to the evidence because motivations are here, motivations are there, but it really comes down to what the evidence is. The evidence in this one was unlike, and the evidence, the way the evidence was twisted or turned or whatever it was interpreted, was unlike anything anybody had really ever seen in a murder case.
Right.
And we're going to get into that.
We are going to get into that.
Oh, I have a chill just thinking about it.
I'm intrigued. I can't wait to start talking about it. So, until then, we've got some bitching to do.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
All rise.
Call the first witness.
How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?
Welcome to On the Stand. Every week we bring an idea, person, place, or thing, something that is on our mind to the stand. We're either prosecuting it or defending it. And after a nice hearty discussion, we decide if said thing is guilty or not guilty. So I think I'm going to start today's off.
I love this for you.
So today on the stand, I am bringing the concept of hot alcoholic beverages.
Ooh.
Which is a very wintertime sort of a thing. I don't think anybody is drinking a really, really hot...
A toddy.
Or in July.
Irish coffee. Or
an Irish right coffee
now.
At the beach, as yeah. you do.
It's a very... It's a
Doesn't
holiday.
Doesn't seem like a terrible idea, frankly, no. But I want to see where you're going with this
I
first.
Mean, listen, I can always have something to warm my hands up, even sure. in like 90 degrees.
Even here in Billy's cold, cold house, I'm just blowing on my hands. A hot yeah. toddy would do me well right now.
No, I have cold extremities always. So yes, the concept of a hot alcoholic beverage. I don't think everybody loves them, but I personally adore.
Love
a hot toddy. Ooh. I was recently sick. I think that there is no, I didn't have COVID. There is no better thing to drink when you're sick than a hot toddy. And all a hot toddy is some tea of your choice. It can be caffeinated, non-caffeinated, some lemon, fresh lemon,
ooh,
some honey.
Oh.
And just a couple shots of whiskey.
Yes.
One yeah. shot or a couple or a whole, you know, half of it is whiskey. Whatever you want to do. The hotness of the beverage, it really cuts with the alcohol.
Yeah.
And it makes it go down very, very nicely.
So it's nice and smooth. One of my favorite beverages I've ever had was like, I don't know, it was an outdoor thing a couple years ago. And I had like a hot chocolate with like peppermint schnapps in it. And like some vodka in it. And it was like a walk around event at the in the cold.
Yes.
And that was the fucking best drink ever. And I'm like, why don't we do this more often? It's like, because we live in Southern California and we're sweating balls most of the time.
Yeah.
That being said, though, when it is cold enough, I live for this.
I love a hot toddy.
Mm. Yeah.
Eggnog is not hot, right?
No, but I love eggnog.
But there is a hot buttered rum that you can make that is fantastic. It's almost, there is also a... If you want to get to, because you know Universal Studios and Hogwarts is right near us, butterbeer. But doing butterbeer, they do a hot butterbeer, and then you can actually get a shot in the hot butterbeer if you bring it into
a shot of what?
A shot of like whiskey or something.
Oh,
yeah. Into if you bring it into the Hogsmeade. What is the? Everyone's going to kill me for not knowing the name of the fictional. I know.
The thing with
the boar's head, something maybe.
Yeah, butterbeer was a little bit disappointing.
I liked it.
It's like a cream soda.
It was shockingly... Well, it tastes like root beer and butterscotch.
Yeah.
It was like this amazing marriage. I really liked it. I don't like shit like this. So I was surprised when I tried it finally after... I just went to Hogwarts this year as an adult.
Such
and
a delight.
I loved it. I went for a Horror Nights, so I hadn't been there before. And I tried a butterbeer and I was like, I was not disappointed.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not a Harry Potter fan.
I love it. Okay. I forgot about that.
But I am a Slytherin. I don't know if that shocks some people or not at all.
It shocks absolutely no
one. It shocks no one.
I'm a true Slytherin and I feel good about it.
One of my other favorite hot alcoholic beverages is a mulled wine. I think everybody should drink a mulled wine.
Why do they call it that? It's not good PR for this brand.
Mold.
Mold wine.
Mold. It's not mold.
Yeah, but you say it. It sounds like mold.
Mold.
It's not what you said.
A moldy wine.
That's right. No one wants it.
No, mold wine is so good.
Mold. Mold with
just
you.
Just say spiced wine. I think that's
spiced wine.
Say.
Mold wine. I feel like that's just like the classic name for it. Okay.
All right.
Well, hot alcoholic bevies.
Not guilty. No, fantastic.
Dude, resounding not guilty.
Let me know what you decide to make, my friends,
okay.
for this holiday
season. Yes. All right. Now, I'm going to go.
Okay.
Let me tell you something. I'm going to go. You did hot. I'm going to do cold.
Cold alcoholic beverages?
No, I'm going to do cold this. This has been a point of contention with me and Alexis for a while.
Oh, no. Mm.
Okay. Now, when you have a ice tray and you get rid of, and you it's fully full.
Oh, God.
And then you take out half of the ice cubes, let's say, and then you put them in a drink. What do you do then?
Fill up the ice tray.
What if you know you're going to drink in the next... 30 minutes, because then if you crack it open again, those are going to just not be cold.
Ooh, I love this. So we need to really consolidate what you're putting on the stand right now.
Yeah. What exactly are you putting on the stand?
Filling up a half filled ice tray.
When
with
you know
water.
You're when you know you're going to be drinking again in the next 30
minutes. Specific. No. Honestly, you're bad at this. You're bad at this. No. Like, I love you so much, but like, you're really bad at this game. Like, you can't be like, and there's 60 caveats. It's like, no, you filling up an ice cube tray is the fucking normal thing to do.
Not when it's half full though, because then if you use it again, then when you crack the ice, all the brand new ice.
Yeah, hypothetically is though, gone. You have more than one tray, so like you use the other one so that you can continue. If you
and
don't,
then,
here's the thing: if you don't have an ice maker, it's the only reason you'd have an ice cube tray. So you need to always be refilling them, otherwise you fucking run out.
And there's nothing worse than not having ice.
Yes, and you are gonna, you never have ice, so you should honestly take this advice. That would be very nice. Made it a poem for you.
I you know what? We're gonna stop right here. I'm gonna say guilty. You guys are gonna say not guilty. Tell us what you think in the Facebook group because
let's hear it. Let me set the scene.
I'm also not clear on what he's saying.
I know exactly what he's saying, but it's to a very specific. Again, Taylor, who does our social media. I'm so sorry.
Love you,
I don't
Taylor.
Know how you're gonna figure out this slide for our Instagram, but I understand what Billy's saying. If you have people over and everybody's drinking. And you use part of the ice, do you fill up the rest of the ice cube tray? Now, this actually sounds like a really good premise for a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode.
Sure.
Because I could feel Larry David feeling very strongly about, I don't know which side.
He would say no.
I would say, I think no too, because he would try to like crack it and then it would spill everywhere.
Yeah, no, he'd say, I don't relate. I have an ice cube maker.
No, but no, I could see, he would be on Billy's side for sure. But the problem is then you run out of ice twice as fast and then you're stuck with hot champagne with no ice. And then maybe you just make yourself a hot toddy at that point.
Hashtag champagne problems.
Okay. So the concept of filling up part of an ice cube tray when you still have frozen ice still in it, I'm going to say not guilty.
I'm going to agree. Not guilty. I want more ice more of the time.
Guilty.
All right. Lex.
All right, Lex.
Your turn.
Okay, so also sorry for your loss, Billy. Rest in peace.
By the way, I did just remember this. The ground on Billy's kitchen is so fucking wet.
From like, filling up the ice cube trays?
From filling up the ice cube trays. I was just slopping around in there with my bare feet. It's very wet and...
Well, that explains why Billy's feet are like cold and dead. He's probably just sloshing around his ice water all over the floor.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing all the time.
Literally, with his like...
Not when you guys are here filling up the ice cream trays constantly.
Snowshoeing around his house. Okay, so December 9th is where we are.
Yes.
Thanksgiving just was passed. Christmas is upon us. Mm-hmm. We've got the Jewish holidays. We've got all sorts of things to look forward to. Something that you guys might notice when you visit family and friends, some of them might... require you to remove your shoes when you arrive.
Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. And I am fascinated by this concept. I was taught, I don't know by who, but somebody in some productivity fucking conversation I was having was like, hey, I'm more productive at home if I have shoes on.
Oh.
And I'm realizing this is true. If you wake up, even if you're in your jammies and you put your shoes on, if you're working from home, for example, you immediately just are more productive.
Okay.
Because you're not in this mode that like, I can't move. You have shoes on, you like go take the trash out. You're just a lot less inhibited with like the things you're going to do.
Okay.
So like, I love having shoes on inside.
Like a sneaker.
A sneaker or truly anything. Like
even like an UGG?
An UGG is perfect. But like, I love the, like some people don't allow shoes in their home.
Yeah.
And I am putting that on the stand. I think that people need their shoes to feel safe, feel productive. And like, I get that you're dragging germs in. Like, that is not lost on me. But like, that being said, we're exposed to so many germs, so many other ways. I don't know that that's going to be the make or break.
Yeah.
Unless you have white carpets. And even then, shame on you.
For having carpet.
I think like shoes, people... If you're having people over, you can't make people take their shoes off.
You know what? I'm going to say that... We've conflated because we do work at home. We never used to work at home.
Yeah.
We all used to work. So home was supposed to be a sanctuary. It was someplace that you could relax. And there are certain
people have always worked at home.
And there's certain people in certain cultures that they want you to take off your shoes.
Yeah,
I remember that one of my very first friends in kindergarten, Henry Hong, went to his house, had to take off your shoes.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I was into it. You know what I mean? Just like you didn't like it at first because like it felt weird to be in somebody else's house without your shoes on. But then eventually you got into it. I don't particularly do it in my house, but I'm all for it. Anything that makes the experience of going to somebody's house kind of different or whatever and makes everybody comfortable, I'm all for it.
I would say unless there, you know, there is a cultural reason for you to have that, or unless you literally have white carpets in your entire home and having a shoe touch those would make a massive problem. Then like,
People want their fucking shoes. And if you remember the Sex and the City episode with Carrie Bradshaw going to the baby shower, her Manolos were stolen.
Oh. Because
they forced her to take her shoes off.
Yeah.
And then the host had to pay for them. Mm. Don't be that person.
Also, it's really easy to clean hardwood floors or any hard any surface. So a sneaker or a shoe in a place with a hard, just
don't have people do a little over. But like if you're that uptight, don't have people over.
Mm.
Like, I'm just like, you're obviously plagued by this like fear. Mm. Maybe entertaining at your home is not for you. Cause I bet you that isn't where your fear lot ends. I bet you there's more.
It's manifesting.
Well, it was in the same, like there's other episodes of Sex and the City where it's like, you can't drink brown things at this home. It's like, you're probably the same person who doesn't want shoes at your house. So like maybe rent a hall and have people there instead. Okay. So as far as the matter of having people over and requiring to remove their shoes, I'm going to call that fucking guilty.
Guilty.
Not guilty. What?
He's not wearing shoes.
Alexis is wearing shoes. She's the only one.
No, I don't require it in my house.
You wore Croc sandals. You didn't wear shoes. I didn't wear shoes that could be easily removed.
Well, that's why I wear easily removable shoes, because I know I'm going to be somewhere. I'm going to want to kick them off and...
Aren't that's right.
Feet she, freezing?
Yeah,
she never knows when she's going to have to jump
Jack,
on a plane.
Jack is miserable. What kind of host are you?
Jesus. Okay, well, when we come back.
Wear a first degree sweatshirt.
She is.
That's right.
When we come back, it is time for some True Crime Rewind.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for all of your springtime goals. If you don't have time, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. So you just get to eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. You really just heat and savor the good stuff without all of the stress. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Plus, you can pause and reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution to premium, fast meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I'm so busy, so it's amazing to just have Factor meals in the fridge for whenever I realize that I'm starving and I don't have any time to cook anything. They're amazing, they're healthy, and they keep you fueled all day long. Head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't, and the real world makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For the real world, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on therealreal.com using code FIRST. That's therealreal.com using the code FIRST.
Yeah, it's rewind time.
Welcome, everyone, to True Crime Rewind. Like we said at the top of the show, today is December 9th, and this is when Michael Peterson claimed that he found his wife, Kathleen, unconscious at the bottom of their stairs in their Forest Hills mansion in Durham, North Carolina.
Yes.
Now, an autopsy said that the 48-year-old woman, Kathleen, she had multiple injuries, including fracture of the superior cornu of the left thyroid cartilage and 7 lacerations on the top and back of her head. Now, they said that this was consistent with blunt force trauma, something hit her.
The prosecution said that.
Yes, and the blood loss actually happened about 90 minutes after sustaining the injuries. Like, she had died from that. She was basically just bleeding out while this was happening.
She didn't die.
Right.
Immediately.
Right. So, the prosecution said that the murder was most likely committed with a fireplace poker called a blow poke. Now, this blow poke they were looking for, and it was missing from the house during the investigation.
So they're like, that must be the murder weapon.
And the reason why they know about this blow poke is because the sister of Kathleen had given it to her that last Christmas and said, like, I saw it by the fireplace. They used it. And apparently at the scene, this blow poke was not where it was supposed to be. And it became a focal point of this investigation and this trial.
And they're thinking the blow poke is what made the lacerations on her head.
Yes. Exactly. Because it like aligned in some way.
Right.
And it was a custom made blow poke. So, but then later in the trial, the defense team actually finds the blow poke. And they said that it was in the garage. You guys missed it.
And it was covered in like cobwebs. Yeah. So it looked like it hadn't been moved.
So there's no way that they could have been like, it had been planted or anything.
It had been untouched for a really long time. Now, on top of that, so the defense also brought out Henry Lee, who we've spoken to before. And he said that, testifying about blood spatter. There was a lot of blood.
Is Henry Lee a blood spatter expert?
He's a forensic expert. He does a bunch of stuff, not just blood spatter. And he said that the blood spatter that was at the bottom of the stairs was consistent with a fall, an accidental fall. So,
which, by the way, we need to, obviously, if people aren't that familiar with this case, there was a fuck ton of blood.
A lot of blood.
There was blood all over the walls, all over the ground. Like, that was one of the things when I first watched it. I was like, this person looked like they were fucking beaten to death because I didn't realize there'd be so much blood from a fall if there was. It was everywhere.
Yeah, it was bad.
So, yes, exactly. So that was where we were at now. As far as, remember, he had said that she had fallen down the stairs after consuming a bunch of drinks and also drinking Valium. And he eventually, after he was convicted in 2003, the jury said, no, you know what? He killed his wife. But after 8 years, he was granted a new trial because they said that the prosecution witness, a critical witness, had actually given misleading testimony. And then that's going to get us into some of the theories that had come out during the trial and then during the second trial.
So one of the first things that I think I want to talk about is the blood spatter kind of a thing. Because if you watch the Sierra case, you kind of see there's this video recorded thing of these blood spatter people,
quote unquote experts,
that are trying to,
recreate the blood spatter.
Recreate and prove that the blood spatter would be from a homicide.
Right. So we see them trying to recreate blood spatter that is consistent with what they found at the scene. And unfortunately, though, the whole thing was filmed, and they had to try over and over and over. And when they finally get it, dozens of times after that, they're like cheering because they're like, "We did it!" And it's like, but it's indicative of the fact that like blood spatter in a certain pattern can come about in several ways, and you shouldn't have to try so hard to recreate it if this is a person's life on the line.
Yeah,
right. Well, and that's there was a. I remember there was this one kind of like scene in that this guy was, he had like a knife against his shirt and he was trying to do this like curved sort of a move where it would have the knife print curved in blood. And he had to do this like perfect little like swoop on his shirt. And it's just like, when you kind of think about these expert
witnesses,
they're like trying their goddamn hardest to prove something that they want to prove like that. It's so ass backwards.
Yeah. I struggle with it a lot because in this case in particular, the Michael Peterson case, I think is so fascinating. and demonstrates how much you have to scrutinize evidence on both sides, because neither make him seem guilty or innocent to me. Like,
no.
Like her falling organically down the stairs and him beating her to death, still in my head, shouldn't have that much blood. Like,
no.
There's literally no reason for it. And I think it's just one of those things where it's like, sometimes things just defy our understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a fall down the stairs in such a way that just hits the wrong artery could create that much blood. That being said, is he such an expert criminal that he did this and got away with it? There's no murder weapon other than this blow poke that hadn't been used. Like, neither incriminate or convict him to me. Like, that's why expert testimony is so scary, because like there's no obvious outcome. It's too subjective.
It's like fucking insane.
Yeah. Too subjective.
So then theories started coming about. So in 2009, a friend of the Petersons, a guy named Larry Pollard, who was an attorney, he re-examined the evidence, and he said that he had found these owl feathers and pine needles in Kathleen Peterson's hands, in her fists. He comes up with the idea that an owl attacked Kathleen, causing her to run inside the house, trips, falls over, hits her head, goes down the steps, and then on the first part of the steps, actually, and then falls down. Now, also said that the lacerations were consistent of those talons. Like, basically, what he's saying is that she's trying to pull this...
It was like latching onto her hair. And her head. Yeah.
She's trying to pull it off, and then that's what's going on now. Now, they brought in some bird experts. They said, yeah, it's possible. And
it's very that's where possible. We're at. Like, literally, I'm on Comon News, which is like a San Juan Island, Washington local newspaper. Mm-hmm. This is 2020, Friday Harbor, which is where my grandma lives. Hey, Grandma. Aggressive owls are attacking visitors to the San Juan Island National Historic Park, and officials are warning people to exercise caution. Officials say owls usually do not attack humans in the fall, but this year, owl attacks have also been reported elsewhere in Washington State. So it's like, it's a thing. It's a thing to be attacked by an owl. This is not a thing.
Sure.
I'm curious to know about these feathers he found.
There was like microscopic feather. Like, there's feathers in her fist.
I struggle with this microscopic aspect.
Yeah, microscopic is hard, because microscopic shit could be. I could have something on me from
and that's
Europe.
That's the thing. That's shaky sort of evidence for me. I'm like, microscopic. Okay.
Yeah.
We all have microscopic shit everywhere.
It was tiny owl feathers. It wasn't microscopic. Yeah. And pine needles gripped in her fists.
That is something.
Gripped in your fist is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
Dude, because if you're trying to because like imagine an owl's talons are digging into your neck and head, you're obviously going to be reaching, trying to grab it off you. Mm-hmm. But would you have a microscopic feather? I feel like I'd have a wing in my hand.
Mm-hmm. Like, also, what about the...
just a tiny. I feel like I'd have like chunks of feathers in my hand if this owl was fucking killing me.
Right. Well, and also, I just have a question. I don't even know if any of us know this. Like, from what I know, I don't think she had any like defensive wounds on her, right?
Not that I know of.
That anybody knows of. And then, but then also like the aspect of like having like a fist, like if you're trying to like protect yourself from somebody attacking you, do you think that your hands would maybe be in like an open?
Also fist member is a, you could fall down and like your hand kind of like goes into a fist and stuff like that.
That being said, none of this is relevant if like she's attacked and she doesn't know it.
That's true.
And she hits her fucking head and it's suddenly like, once you've hit your head, like you don't know how the level of disorientation you've experienced.
Totally.
So it's like, she could have been like, hit the owl and maybe plucked one, but like you're not in the same defensive.
It's also you're falling down the stairs. So it's like whatever normal thing that your body would do.
That woman bled. So it's like she would have had to have sustained immediately after the owl attack, a hit to the head, which made her like incapacitated to the degree where she couldn't have pulled feathers out. You know, again, this is an example of like how nuanced the possibilities
and how, like,
of crime scenes are.
And unknown.
Yes. But now we're going to take you to some other evidence that might say the owl theory is hogwash, because in the 1980s, Michael Peterson lived in Germany. He was stationed there with his first wife and their two children. And they go to a dinner party. Michael was one of the last people to leave, and a family friend named Elizabeth was found dead at the bottom of the stairs in A Pool of Blood, very, very similar to Kathleen Peterson.
Yeah.
And they, I think we're all living on the same, they live like right with them in like a neighboring property.
It was a very close family friend of theirs.
So it was like, but they were living, it's relevant because they were living like next door or something within this close proximity to this family friend.
Right. Now, here's one of the things is that Peterson actually promised to take care of Elizabeth's daughters and ended up adopting them.
Yeah.
Which is kind of odd too. They initially said that she had a brain hemorrhage and then she fell down the stairs.
Well, she was prone to aneurysms. She had a history of aneurysms in her family. So I think what people chalked it up to when that happened was like she had an aneurysm and she fell down the stairs. Yeah. And that's sort of what everyone accepted.
But during the murder trial of Kathleen, they actually exhumed Elizabeth's body and did another autopsy. And they said this was homicide. They couldn't prove it was Michael, but you have two women that he knew.
Died very eerily.
What did they base those findings on? I'm not sure. Okay.
Well, the thing that's interesting to me about that, like, obviously that's the craziest fucking coincidence, but I don't know what his motive, if he did that to Elizabeth, like, I don't know what the motive was.
I don't see one.
There wasn't any clear motive at all. It didn't seem like he was having an affair with her. Like, there was no, like, monetary thing. He ended up taking her.
No,
ended up raising her children, but, like, I don't think he'd want to do that.
It's just something that is brought up because it is an amazing. Pretty amazing coincidence.
I agree. Okay? And I think like people are going to take that kind of risk, like ruin their lives, go to prison. Like you got to really fucking want to do it.
Yeah.
And I just don't, there's no reason to here.
Now,
you know?
Now there was also another thing too, is that the daughters of Kathleen had learned that he was in a gay affair.
Yeah.
And that he was bisexual. They initially believed that he was innocent. Once they learned this, they turned and then said that he was guilty.
But it wasn't even a affair. It was literally just sex. Like, it was like he was hiring someone.
Yeah.
He wasn't in an emotional affair. It was just like he was hiring sex workers.
But then what he was saying too is that Kathleen knew about it and she was okay about it. But of course the prosecution is like, here's your motive. Like, she just found out about it. She was on the computer and she found something from the...
No, they crafted this narrative that was like, explained how this happened this night. And what helped them is that the family was like, she never would have been okay with this. And his argument was like, she knew and she accepted me for who I was.
Yeah.
The reason why no one knows is because the stigma. Mm-hmm. And she didn't want to subject herself to that judgment.
Right.
Both can be...
Honestly, this is the thing with this case. I'm like, both make
sense.
Dude,
I have friends who have partners, male partners, who are bi, where they're like, well, they used to sleep with men, but like, they don't want any, like, they're telling me, and it is still shocking because we're not used to hearing about it. Do I judge it? No.
Yeah.
But it's not the norm yet. It's still, there's a taboo aspect. And I think years ago, decades ago, it kind of tracks with what he's saying. That being said, it could be totally, totally made up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, who fucking knows? But both can be true. And that's why these cases divide people and perplex people.
And then, yes. And then finally, the last thing is, was there an insurance policy?
Yeah.
And there was. How much? $1.8 million in life insurance. Everybody pointed to that and said, you know, the family actually, they were carrying $142,000 in debt and credit card and credit line debt. $1.8 million could have been the reason for potentially doing this.
Which again, I think is so interesting. I mean, it goes again back to like the conversation that we had with Payne, where it's like once you start digging into people's personal lives and their shit, like there's always going to be something that you could say as a motive for literally anything. And again, with this case, it really is the one case that I don't have an opinion on. Like, I don't think I know enough. I don't think there's enough information that, like, everybody has been given to make an actual opinion on if he did it or not. Like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But, like, of course, everybody has weird shit going on behind the closed doors. They really do.
Well, the reason he was given the opportunity for an Alford plea, which is what he ultimately took, which says, which says, you know, I'm pleading guilty to this Alford plea because there is enough evidence to convict me. But I didn't do it.
Yeah.
The reason he's doing that is because, like, the character sort of assassination against him for his bisexuality, it's kind of unconstitutional. And if he had a really good lawyer, they would have nipped that in the bud initially. Not all lawyers do. But if you remove that aspect, there's very little against him.
And also,
in terms of conclusive evidence, especially excluding the blowpoke, which was like,
yeah,
bunk. Because again, the expert who came up with that evidence had no experience.
Right.
He never should have been testifying to this.
Going back to like the affair thing, like it is also interesting because it was with a man. Like if it was with a woman, would it have gotten the attention that it did? If he was just having a non-emotional, like...
I think it would have.
Yeah,
I
mean, look at Scott Peterson.
The same thing. Or
true.
Or David Camp, like which we just covered.
Yeah, well, there was no one person, but just adultery, it just colors. Yeah. So as much as...
But Scott Peterson was way sketchier than he was.
Well, yeah, like, he was literally on the phone with his mistress during the vigil for his wife. So yeah, it's a lot different.
It is different.
But I think like what people need to realize is that like you can't condemn a person for murdering someone based on their sketchy character flaws.
Yes.
Exactly.
Like, because everyone's sketchy in their own way.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's...
Again, I just like, I don't know. I still don't know.
I don't know either. And I think it's impossible to know at this point because, like, what I need everyone to hear is that, like, every shred of evidence that you hear through the media of someone's guilt or possible innocence is through like 1,000 lenses.
Well, and also it's the media that's paid. Like, but like, of course there's going to be some angle.
Well, media is not paid by like, it's just more every lens, like the detective has a lens. The detective right. thinks you're guilty. Everything coming out of that's going to seem guilty. The prosecutor thinks you're guilty. Everything will. Like, there's no way to stop this sort of
Yeah,
you can never see something in a truly objective way because it's been put through several fucking lenses yes. of people's opinions.
Well, and then also the fact that like you have to go back to like the fact that everything is done by humans and there's human error in everything that they're doing, that they're saying. And then if you're compounding human error on top of human error on top of human error on top of bias,
opinion, on top of opinion yes. and like confirmation bias and all that stuff. It's just like,
it's shit gets so fucking warped.
That's why you should always fucking reserve your judgment unless you're in the fucking courtroom.
Yeah.
Unless you're in the court. And even then, like you have to realize everything that the police present to the defense attorneys and the prosecutors, they only say what they want.
Yeah.
Like right. you don't know the truth literally unless you are fucking there.
Well, yes. That's the thing. Unless it's like, it's been videotaped, you have a fucking confession, and you have DNA. It's like, I can't believe anything.
I know. And even worse, like, I'm just learning about DNA in the sense that, like, parts of it are subjective.
Right.
Did you know that?
Only through you.
Like, parts of DNA are fucking objective. When you're dealing with multiple DNA samples, how they're analyzed and what relation they could have to each other is subjective.
Yes. You have to say that though. And you have to say also when you're dealing with touch DNA though, but you can't, we can't go out and say like part of it is subjective and just lay it out there without a bigger conversation about it. Though.
Meaning what?
Meaning that it throws.
Part of it is subjective.
Sure. Part of it is subjective, but most of it isn't.
Listen, so DNA was obviously supposed to when you're dealing with big DNA samples, like comparing this blood against that blood, that's super easy and easy. It's when we're dealing with multiple samples all mixed together and how those are analyzed.
Right.
That analysis is subjective.
Like if there was a murder with defensive wounds and people's blood was mixed together, is that what you're saying?
Several samples.
Yeah.
And if you're like,
it's mostly with touch DNA, even if it's, if there's a woman that potentially has had 5 sexual partners.
Yeah.
That is a lot less subjective. That you can actually figure out a lot more. Separate the DNA samples and figure out who they are.
Like, if a woman had several sexual partners and they can be like, she had sex with several people.
Sure.
But you can't know who did it.
Who did it? No, but you can still identify them though. Where the place that it gets that it gets really tricky is the matter of touch DNA.
The number of alleles.
And the number of touch DNA.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well,
we'll get into that.
That's for another episode. But for now, we are going to hear about the worst things that you people have all done.
Dun dun dun. Bum bum.
You are a horrible person.
What's the worst thing you've ever done?
Hello, worst people ever. We're so excited to have you, and we're so excited. I mean, I'm so excited. I listened to a bunch of the call submissions we got today, and I was really thrilled because a lot of you explained that what you had done has been plaguing you for a long time.
Mm.
And you're like, I regret this forever or not. This one in particular that I'm so excited for y'all to hear, I love this. And I hope you never regret what you've done. Because this, you are a woman of my own heart.
I can't wait.
Ugh. Billy? Excited?
Very excited.
Yeah, he looks riveted. Stand by.
Hello, Alexis, Jack, and Billy. Okay. Here is the story of the worst thing I've ever done. So a little bit of backstory. I was raised in a very conservative mainstream religion. Like, I was able to go to public school, but like, and wear pants, but I wasn't allowed to have a steady boyfriend, and it was strongly discouraged for you to have friends outside of the religion, right? Unless you were trying to convert them, and that was fine. But anyway, I get married at 18 because that's what you did. And the abuse started physically, emotionally, sexually on our wedding night, which super sucks. So I go through this marriage for almost 2 years. I hit rock bottom. I leave my ex-husband in the church at the same time. And I have access to no resources. I live in a pretty rural area. My family is all a part of this church. So I'm living out of my SUV. I go and I get a job. And so I'm doing that. And I start to make friends through my job, which, okay, cool. So I get invited to this party. I go to the party. Pretty cool people. They're all super nice and chill. We're drinking. We're hanging out. There's a bonfire. That sort of thing. I meet this guy. Super nice. So, you know, one thing starts to lead to another, and we decide to kind of sneak off into the woods a little bit. So, because I'm living out of my SUV, but because it's cluttered with shit, I don't want to really offer that up. So I grab a blanket out of my car. And then we go out into the woods, we hook up, it's fun, we go back to the party, it's all good, right? So about a day or two later, I start to notice there are some issues with my nether bits downstairs. And I'm like, oh no, like, we use protection. I'm freaking out because I'm thinking it's an STD, that kind of thing. So I go to my OBGYN and she examines me and then she's like, so my OBGYN looks at me and is like, hey, it's not an STD. Are you allergic to poison ivy? And I'm like, oh, wow. Yeah, I am a lot. Turns out poison ivy oil will go through a blanket if there's not a waterproof membrane. So I had poison ivy all up in my badge, all over my thighs, everything covered in it. So I'm like, wow, okay. She prescribes me a steroid. I'm waiting for the prescription to be filled. It's a big prescription. I ended up having to take it for 2 months. But anyway, so I'm waiting for the prescription to be filled. This is all when I'm separated from my first ex-husband and waiting for the divorce finalization to happen. The day after I'm diagnosed with poison ivy all over my crotch, we have our final divorce hearing. We're there, and my super shitty abusive ex, after all the proceedings are done, looks at me with a shitty-ass grin, nods towards his truck, and is like, hey, want to have a car quickie to, like, as goodbye sex? And I look at him and I go, yes, yes, I do. So we go into his truck and we have quote unquote goodbye breakup sex. And I leave full well knowing he's going to have poison ivy dick in about 24 to 48 hours. And then I also went and changed my phone number with my cell carrier, and he didn't know where I was living because I was living out of my car and it was transient at the time. So I don't know exactly if he, I'm sure he figured out eventually, but yeah. So the version of that story that I usually have told people cuts off before I gave my ex poison ivy dick. So here's my suggestions to everyone out there. One, if you're going to have sex in the woods, make sure you can identify the plant that you're going to do it on top of. And two, if you accidentally get poison ivy all over your crotch, make sure you find someone who really deserves it to give it to them too, because they fucking deserve it. Anyway, I love the show, guys. You're amazing. Hope you enjoy this. Bye.
Oh my gosh. There are so many things.
So much to unpack.
There's so much I love about this story. First of all, you broke out of a very restricting, abusive religion at once. You broke away from your family and your husband and decided to live in your car to escape an abusive situation. Holy shit. Congrats to you. And many accolades to you for having the strength to do that, because I don't know that I would.
Yeah.
Second of all, you were living your best life and having some fun, sexy hookups in the woods and shit like that. Also, congrats to you. You deserve that after such a constricting sort of chains, if you will, mm-hmm, prior. Mm-hmm. And you got poison ivy, which is awful.
Awful.
I'm from the East Coast.
In the lady parts.
Dude, awful. I'm from the East Coast. I've gotten poison ivy. I've gotten poison sumac. I've gotten all the poisoned rashes you can get.
Yeah.
From rolling around in the woods a lot. I feel you. And it is a true fucking nightmare.
Ugh.
That being said, I appreciated your whole, the outcome of what happened after that final divorce proceeding, because you were in an abusive situation, and if he got a rash, then he deserves it.
I mean, again, it's one of these that's straight out of a movie.
Yes.
I think after a few years, we should probably write a script for a TV show.
Right?
Because the stories write themselves. This is insane.
Yeah.
Insane. And honestly, not the worst thing you could have ever done to a piece of shit that fucking deserves it.
And who abused you?
Yeah.
He deserves way worse.
Yeah.
And he deserves to probably be in jail.
And what kind of entitlement does this guy have to actually ask for that at the divorce proceedings?
Yeah, honestly, he got what he deserved just for that.
Honestly,
He tempted fate. For mm-hmm. him to be like, oh, I abused you. I treated you like shit for so fucking long. Also, I deserve one last fuck. Go fuck yourself.
Not only that, we're in a proceeding a divorce proceeding. It's not like we just gave each other. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're in court.
It's done.
If you're in court, though, it means that it hasn't been necessarily easy, I don't think.
No.
And it's he deserves all he got, girl. And I love your story.
Poison Ivy dick.
Probably
P-O-D. It's the band.
Probably limp.
Poison Ivy dick.
That's right.
Oh, no, that's P
P I D. That's right. The limpest of the poison ivy decks.
Wow.
That being said, we are on to, are we on to the Costanza Stanzi?
We can jump right into the Costanza Stanzi.
Is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what we have next?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else do you think we have next?
Well, I don't know. Something we haven't brought up yet. I know this whole owl concept.
Oh, yeah.
OG firsties, we want to remind you, we had the owls were sort of our mascot for a while. We were thinking it didn't really take off the way we hoped. Mm-hmm. But
yes, it did. Underground.
The OGs know.
Yeah, the OGs know about the owl.
They know about the owl poem.
Sure. So I wanted to give a little nod to the OGs and be this Costanza Stanza, the subject, the title of the poem is called George as an Owl. George as an Owl.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And here I go. Let me get my posture just right. Looking at George, he looks just like an owl, but instead of a beak, he wears a petulant scowl.
Mm.
But he's not really a bird. He's a man on the prowl. But he has no feathers, rather massive jowls.
Oh, my God.
Okay, but let's be real. If George were a bird, he'd not be an owl. He'd be slower, plumper, a tastier fowl. If George were a bird, what would he be? For sure a raw chicken or a Thanksgiving turkey.
Oh my God, that's amazing. One of the best. You know what? Okay, when we
put a mouth-watering stanza, if you will.
When we put our Costanza stanzas as a book one day, we need to have somebody illustrate it.
Yes.
Honestly, will you guys start submitting? We need this.
We need, because I think
that, yes, like, you can, we need our artists.
Like, there is a perfect illustration to go along mm-hmm. with this poem.
Like George Costanza as a raw chicken.
Mm-hmm. Well, or it's like, it's literally like it's
very close to Kramer as the turkey, remember?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
A tastier fowl. Yes. All of that.
Yes.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you for your support during this difficult time. Bye-bye.